I'd like to introduce the speaker. First speaker, being a guy's recovery, I expect a lot. And I'm going to share again on the NA history. Help me welcome Al.
I'm an addict. My name's Al. Do I really need this? Do I need this thing? Is this being taped?
Yeah.
No, it is? Okay.
It's in the room, though.
Okay. Guess we're using this thing. I mean, where do you start when you're talking about NA history? A lot of us know that NA was Narcotics Anonymous. I was going to say as we know it, but it wasn't as we know it. It was started in July 1953 in Southern California. Actually, it wasn't started there. It had started in different places before that, but never continued consistently to exist. And to the best of our knowledge to date, the continuation of Narcotics Anonymous, anyway, as we know it, started in July 1953 in Southern California. I have a copy of the original minutes from those first meetings of those people that met in Southern California on the table there, and I was just glancing through them as I while the readings were going on, and a lot of it has to do with the combination of Alcoholics Anonymous with Narcotics Anonymous. As it's listed there in the minutes, it's called the San Fernando Valley AANA group. That's what the name of the group was. And, I guess and obviously we've come a little way since then, quite a way since then, and Narcotics Anonymous, today, absolutely stands on its own right as its own fellowship and, as we know it. History is a hard thing to talk about because, if you went to the store and bought four different books on U.S. history, you'd probably get four different perceptions as to what happened. And the thing that I'm most well-versed in is NA history as it relates to the Greater Philadelphia region, because that's the history of NA that I participated in. I know for a fact that a lot of NA groups started in Southern California, and even after the first 20 years, I believe, there still wasn't a whole lot of NA anywhere else besides Southern California. There was still only, to the best of my knowledge, there was still only about 20 groups in Southern California after quite a while of NA being around. And it was at that time that the members started to see a need for really looking at the 12 traditions and how the 12 traditions could affect the growth of the fellowship. And it was kind of around that time that NA really started to grow and started to branch out into other areas. Today, we have Narcotics Anonymous exists in approximately 45 different countries, a whole bunch of different languages. One of the problems that we're experiencing today is with the translation of literature and translating it into other languages so that other members in other places can, use the literature the way we use it. Obviously we've come a real long way. The history of the Greater Philadelphia region, Narcotics Anonymous started here approximately 20 years ago. And it was the Narcotics Anonymous that started in Philadelphia was, again, the first consistent NA on the East Coast. There was reports of other meetings that had started in the late 40s and stuff in New York City, but those groups, for one reason or another, due to the, I forget what the law was called, but there was a law in New York City that addicts, for one reason or another, they couldn't congregate. It was against the law for addicts to congregate in one place, so that they really couldn't have openly scheduled meetings, and as a result, I guess it never really took off. But the in the greater Philadelphia region, it's approximately 20 years old, coming up on 20 years. Even when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, there wasn't a whole lot of Narcotics Anonymous to come to. There was a few isolated groups. If you wanted to make 7 NA meetings a week, you had to put a couple hundred miles on your car, probably. You know, and obviously we don't have that problem today. Although there are places in the continental United States, different places where there is still only isolated groups of NA. But like I said, there wasn't a whole lot of NA to come to. There was the first meeting I made was a meeting in Bucks County in Bristol. At that time, there was a meeting called the Oxford Circle Group, which I think is still in existence, right? The Oxford St. Martin's Church. There was a meeting at 4th and Pine, which is now the 3rd and Walnut Group. They just switched meeting places, I guess, maybe about, I'm not sure exactly how long ago, 8 or 9 years ago. That was, you know, we knew of Narcotics Anonymous in Allentown. Some things were getting going in Allentown. Some things were happening in Ocean City. There was no Narcotics Anonymous in New York. Narcotics Anonymous in New York, I think, didn't come until about 1981. And once Narcotics Anonymous started to take off in New York, it just caught like wildfire, and it's, you know, probably still going that way. You know, it's still going like wildfire. You know, if any of you were listening to Dutch share just before this, he was sharing about some of the things that happened, and you know, nobody knew anything about the steps. We used to do things like we'd go to the meeting and then go skinny dipping after the meeting, or we'd go to the meeting and go tear up a diner somewhere after the meeting. We got thrown out, at least in Bucks County, I know we were banned from just about every diner in Bucks County at one time or another, because we would go in there and just raise all kinds of hell. And the whole thing was that there wasn't like recovery as we know it today. There was camaraderie, there was fellowship, there was a sense of, and Dutch was sharing about that, but there was a sense of like hanging on to each other, you know, come hell or high water. A lot of times that's really not present today. I don't see it at least as much as it was then. But there was a sense of like, we're going to hang on to each other, and, you know, we're going to just hang on to each other for dear life, because that's the only thing that we had to hang on to. And it wasn't until later that, you know, members started to learn things about the need for a sponsor, you know, working the 12 steps, doing those things. I know there's, Bobby's going to share, I know George stepped in, I don't know if he's willing to share or not, I'm sure he has some things that he could share about Narcotics Anonymous, and at least in the greater Philadelphia region. Somewhere along the line, we began to catch wind that there was this thing happening about the writing of the basic text. The only literature that was present at that time was a little white book and a few pamphlets. I think there was another look, What, How, and Why. I forget exactly what pamphlets.
Recovery
and Relapse. There was only a few, you know, a few pamphlets in the little white book. And I remember for a long time carrying a little white book around in my back pocket, and that was like, that was the only literature that you had to read. And you know, after reading it for the 150th time, it was just tattered and stuff, but it was still there. And when that one got totally to the point where, you know, you couldn't carry it around anymore, you just grabbed the new one, you know, carried that. And when I went to this thing, I didn't have the faintest idea what it was, but it was this thing called the First East Coast Convention. And I had no idea what a convention was. You know, nobody knew what a convention was. But a group of us went to that, and that was in June of 1980. We began to learn. We began to see and understand that there was other recovering addicts. There was people there from Georgia, which we had no idea that there was any Narcotics Anonymous in Georgia. And we began to learn that there was NA in other places, that people were recovering NA in other places. You know, we knew of the World Service Office where we wrote for our literature and stuff. And you know, we would write and send money out to the World Service Office, and we'd be lucky if we would get the shipment of literature that we asked for maybe 2 months, 3 months later. Because the World Service Office at that time was in the back of somebody's trunk. That was the World Service Office, and all the, of course, all the services at that time were all completely volunteer. And, I really believe that God doesn't hold us responsible for what we're not aware of yet. But once we become aware of it, then we're held responsible. And, I really believe at that time, like I said, no one knew anything about the steps. Nobody knew anything about sponsorship. The only thing it was is just hanging on to each other for dear life. And, we pretty much did everything and went everywhere together. There was nothing like, you do this and everybody goes to the meet and then everybody goes home and does their own thing after the meeting. There wasn't none of that. It was like, you spent all your time with these, this group of recovering addicts. You went to all the same meetings together. And at that time, it was, we wouldn't think twice about getting in the car and driving to Allentown for a meeting, or getting in the car and going to Ocean City, or going wherever, getting in the car from Bucks County and going down to Center City to go to a meeting was like something that you didn't even think about. It's just a normal part of every, every week. And, sometimes, a lot of times today, I don't have that type of willingness, to go to those kinds of lengths. But at that time, that's what people did. There was a guy had started an NA meeting at the Veterans Administration in Jersey City, which was the only NA meeting in Jersey City at that time. It was a very small group. And there was a guy from Maryland who he's still in recovery, and he was in a wheelchair at the time. And what he used to do was gather a bunch of people, and this other person in the fellowship had a van, and they would pack up the van and they would drive to Jersey City every Thursday night to support this meeting that was going on in Jersey City. They would drive from Washington, D.C., the outskirts of Washington, D.C., to this little meeting in Jersey City to help support it every Thursday night. And that's kind of some of the lengths that some members were willing to go to. The Philadelphia region has a lot of history around the basic text. A substantial amount of work done in the greater Philadelphia region on the basic text. There was some literature conferences that were held within the region. There was members that participated in the writing and stuff of the basic text. And I think it was at that time for, you know, like I said, history on some level is a way how you perceive it. It's, you know, a personal perception. But it was around that time that I really began to see and believe in Narcotics Anonymous the way I believed in it for the past 10 years. Was in meeting these other members who some of them, a lot of them, had started NA in their own respective areas, who there was no NA there before they got there and started it. You know, one guy that I can think of from Memphis that did that, another guy from Atlanta that did that. And they started Narcotics Anonymous, and there was no Narcotics Anonymous to come to before that. And they believed in a fellowship that didn't even exist. And on some levels, I began to do that myself. I began to believe in it that way. I began to see and believe in this in a way that I had never been able to believe in anything before in my life. And I know that there was a lot of other people around me that took on a love and a passion for this, you know, that same way. And probably more than anything else, we wanted to see it grow. You know, more than anything else, we wanted to see more and more people come in. Dutch was talking tonight about a time when I know Bobby and I and some other people, we used to sit and we used to talk about, like, how come there's no black people in Narcotics Anonymous in Philadelphia? You know, and I could, all the black people in the region can count on one hand. And it's pretty obvious that we don't have that problem today, thank God. That, you know, the black members have definitely come into, you know, a presence in Narcotics Anonymous. And there's, there's recovery everywhere in the greater Philadelphia region. It's not just in Bucks County and Center City and out here. It's everywhere. The basic text, at least in my opinion, when the basic text was published in 1982, it was at that time, I think, that the fellowship really, really took off. I think that recovery was, and it still is today, it's a lot different. Recovery in Philadelphia is a lot different than it is in Southern California, which is a lot different than it is in Florida, which is a lot different than it is in Idaho. And, you know, and we're not even talking about the differences that we experience once we start to get outside of the country into, you know, foreign countries and international fellowship. I think one thing that the basic text gave us was, the basic text gave us a common bond. It gave us a common thing that we followed. It gave us a common manual of text on recovery that we could all agree upon, and that was the basis for our recovery. And, you know, you can even go a lot of places, and I travel a lot of times within the region. You can go a lot of different places, and recovery is different in different places just within our own region today. But there is a common bond, and I think the basic text is one of the very first things that really provided that for the fellowship as a whole. And I think as a result of that common bond, what happened was that a lot more meetings started, a lot more people were getting better, and the fellowship really took off. The greater Philadelphia region at one point was comprised South Jersey, pretty much all that the greater Philadelphia region comprises right now. I remember going to a Philadelphia area service meeting. Actually, it was the Philadelphia area first, going to a Philadelphia area service meeting. There being 45, 50 DSRs there, and it was a real zoo. You know, there was, you know, people go to area service and things today, they think it's like real disorganized and it's not, you know, I mean, this is like people offering each other out into the hallway and, you know, all kinds of stuff was going on. One of the things, you know, and on some level we'll always be going through growing pains, but I think at that time there was a lot of growing pains because practically almost everyone went to both fellowships. There was a lot of controversy surrounding that. There was a lot of growing pains and things to go through. And I guess on some level we still have those kinds of things today, you know, different kinds of things, but, you know, somewhat similar. But, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. Like Dutch was sharing, I could go on all night just telling stories about things that happened. And I guess some of them might have some historical value and others probably wouldn't, but I think that what happened somewhere along the line, when we had the Greater Philadelphia region, a few people, we sent a representative out to the World Service Conference. And there was a lot of like division between East Coast. Well, I guess on some levels we still have that too, but there was a lot of division between the East Coast and the West Coast, and the members that we sent out to the World Service Conference went out with what was known as the Philadelphia Plan. Yeah. And I was sharing in the meditation workshop this morning, I was saying that an addict with a plan is like a zebra with a bicycle. You know, it makes no sense at all. And what this plan comprised of is we were going to bring a World Service office to Philadelphia, and the centralization of World Services was going to be in Philadelphia, and of course that didn't work, but I guess on some levels we're still kind of struggling with some of those same issues today in a different way. There was a lot of insanity. There was a lot of self-will. But the bottom line was that we hung in there. We grew. We're still hanging in there. And we're still growing. And when I came around, I could, you know, in what is the Greater Philadelphia region now, I think I knew maybe 3 or 4 meetings tops. And today we have somewhere, and we're slowly coming up on 300 groups in the Greater Philadelphia region. And despite all of the things that happened, all the insanity, all the self-will, all the mistakes that were made, all the money that was ripped off at one time or another, all that stuff, if we were a business, if we were a corporation, and we had the kind of growth that we've had as a fellowship in the past 10 years, we'd be considered to be doing very well. And obviously we are doing very well. I remember a time going to conventions when you went to a convention and you knew 90% of the people that were there. You know, that's definitely not the case today. You went to a convention, the first East Coast convention had, I think, about 175 people at it. You know, and I think this weekend we're talking somewhere close to 4,000 or 5,000. You know, Narcotics Anonymous is growing. And, I'll turn it over to Bobby, and I'm sure he has some interesting stories to tell and some whatever.
Thanks, Al. Hi, everybody. I'm an addict. My name is Bobby. And I certainly could appreciate an awful lot of things. Al, he certainly jumped a lot of things up in my head. It was the Rockefeller Law in New York City that prohibited people from being able to attend meetings. But one of the things I have to just share with you for a moment is simply that I don't know if it's by coincidence or what, but I seem to go to a lot of meetings and they ask me to share on the prefix or the symbol of NA or NA history, you know what I mean? I'd like to be, it's been a long time sharing on recovery type stuff, but as a result of that, I found myself a lot of times, I think like what Al found himself doing is the relationships that come out of that history through our recovery, through other people's recovery, and how that seems to be formulated, I think was really important to see how things happen. Because I too, like you, believe that there could have been 10 people at a particular meeting at a particular time, and when we'd all walk out the door, each one of us would have a different story. So it's very hard to equate, you know, what is history. There was a couple things that are factual, though. I mean, we actually have an archive and some dates to reveal those facts. One of them is that our service structure did begin in 1971. For a long time, as a matter of fact, I had the Philadelphia service structure. I had the log that kept all the names. One of the most interesting things, I guess, one of the most important things to me personally was I can remember when Ray T. had given me the log to hold, and I had it at the first convention, first GPRCNA, and the 10 names, the 10 GSRs from various groups throughout the city were all clean that day. Everyone that was a GSR that had logged in that book was clean that day. And every one of them, 9 out of the 10, okay, and this was 10 years later, had either had 8, 9, or 10 years. You know, so the fact was, to me, was that being involved in service was very important. Being involved in service was critical to one's recovery. That being a part of something and being more than just a member meant more than hanging out. Some of the when Al shared about how small the fellowship was, bless you, and how we would have to travel several hundred miles for meetings. It was true, but that was part of the unification that I think that we needed in order to stay clean. There was a very, very famous line that we used to repeat all the times at meetings, and you would hear it commonly wherever you went, and that was go to any lengths to stay clean a day at a time. And literally, there was a meaning to that, because for us, it was very symbolic. You know, we had to travel many, many miles to stay clean a day at a time, and to us, that meant lengths. That may not be true today, but certainly the message is the same. You know, we have to go through many lengths. I think the most rewarding for me in when trying to reflect on NA history, because my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting was in 1973. I didn't get clean until 19. I didn't surrender until 1981. And through that time span, as a matter of fact, my first sponsor, Dwayne, who was probably the first black in Narcotics Anonymous, and I met him at Sobriety First Group. And Sobriety First Group was that meeting for an awful long time. And Jimmy was at Sobriety First Group. I met Jimmy for the first time there. And outside of that meeting and one in Eagleville and I guess Norristown, Green Basin, there wasn't anything from there until you hit Philadelphia. And then meetings began to spring, you know, in between those areas. But the most revealing thing for me is I think we owe a lot to those people who were here when Narcotics Anonymous really took hold in Philadelphia. After all, I relate it to like one's own personal recovery. if when I came around, I didn't surrender to Narcotics Anonymous and I didn't do the things that helped me stay clean every day, I would use. It requires an unbelievably strong foundation to be able to survive life for me. And I really attribute the reason why I'm here today to that foundation. Because at any time I'm in trouble, I reflect to the very basic things in recovery to stay clean. That relationship, I believe, to our service structure in Philadelphia region, what's now known as the Philadelphia region, is really important. Because if it wasn't for those who put the cornerstones on that building, 1971, guess what? You know, we wouldn't have a room to live in. And it's, I guess, the fortitude, and I have to credit Al, because ever since I've known Al, he's been in service, I mean, he still is, of those people that when it was tough, I can remember starting a meeting, and for about the first 7 months of a year, being the only one in there every single week. You know? And not being able, you know, to wait for a newcomer. To be able to go to meetings, and it was important because there was very few of us, we would go together. So it established, you know, a different type of recovery, because the meeting consisted of the time you were picked up, time you got to the meeting, time we did the meeting, and then time we went out, and then the time everybody got home. So our meetings were long. You know, our meetings were awfully long. And if it wasn't for, I guess, the enrichment of those people that had that fortitude, when Narcotics Anonymous had no literature, really, outside of a white book, recovery and relapse pamphlet, another pamphlet about the time we love others, or for those who love others, which was like a Nar-Anon pamphlet, which we eventually gave to Nar-Anon, 1983. They deserve it. It was that foundation that was created that is really what makes Narcotics Anonymous exist today. And I think sometimes we lose focus. There was a lot of people back then. And not to disclose their anonymity or to break their anonymity. But a lot of them aren't here today, unfortunately. I guess the transition that Narcotics Anonymous has gone through over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years has been traumatically felt by some. You know, there's been a considerable amount of alienation from old-timers that were there then, and a lot of them not understanding today's change. I know I have a hard time accepting change. I was we used to call them the general chairman of Sobriety First Group for a long time. And I knew, and I was very fortunate because when I had surrendered early on, you know, that Good Any Less to Stay Clean had gotten me to World Lit, you know, into the World Literature Services. And as a result of that, I picked up on the terminology, and I picked up on, you know, all the proper things to say and do in Narcotics Anonymous pretty early on, and it was not difficult for me at all to practice that. But I knew that Sobriety First was not a good name for an NA meeting, okay? But there was a certain tradition there. There was a certain value. To me, it was significant because I could relate to those people who started that meeting and the sweat and the tears that they poured into that meeting, you know, to make it work, for it to have still been there years and years and years and years later, you know, I felt that they had the right to own or call, not own, but call that meeting and have that tradition live on in their eyes, you know. And to be quite honest with you, I never had the nerve to be able to change the name of that group, you know, for that reason. And knowing in all goodwill, you know, and any meeting I would ever start would never start with the word sobriety first, guaranteed. But nevertheless, you know, I couldn't do that. I guess that application of tradition, though, is important. One of the traditions that was started in Philadelphia, the idea, as a matter of fact, came up with by Dutch, was that passing the basic text and the exchange of the basic text and the monk was an idea that started here, and it flourished all over the country to where, you know, you see a lot of conventions that do that, make that exchange. Not having a head table started in Philadelphia. We decided that it wasn't, you know, that anybody that was in the selfless service that committed themselves to Narcotics Anonymous, really we were had to be there for the right reasons. And that was a conditioning process, because literally it, you know, you have to have a fairly aggressive personality in those days, and you had to have a pretty strong ego, you know, to get things done. You know, it was like twisting arms. At the first regional convention that we had, you know, we literally had to twist people's arms to get 285 people there. You know, literally had to beg people to come. You know, because the idea was so new, because the change was so new, and you know, it was too new to accept. It was too new to accept, and I guess, you know, there's another instances of our personal recovery having us become adaptable to the changes that take place in Narcotics Anonymous today. And that's tough. You know, it's like the steps teach us to become teachable. You know, but, you know, do I accept change, you know, readily? You know, that's a question. But I guess the main thing is that I can see one belief I know I have is that there's not one person, there's no one group, there's no one area, there's no one region or committee that can tear down this gift. You know, this was a gift from God. The reason why we're all here is because this is where we find our hope, you know, and that hope can only be given to us by something extremely spiritual, something very special, and we don't have to have that fear of whatever change is made, whether it's a positive or a negative in our from our perception. You know, doesn't mean we can't grow from that. It doesn't mean that it's not God's will. Some of the, I guess people came here to hear some facts. The archives would explain to all of us that there wasn't, and I'm sure Danny, I don't know if you brought the booth, the archives booth with all the stuff, huh? But in that, you can find a whole bunch of meeting lists. A meeting list that I remember helped spearheading, that put Norn on the meeting list. Do you remember that, Al? I don't know if you remember that or not. Not too many people were fond of that. They actually caught wind of that. There was a lot of self-will, and there was a lot of manipulation, obviously. And with the small fellowship, you know, it was, to be quite frank, kind of easy. Because, you know what, one of the diseases that addicts have is complacency, obviously. And, you know, when people are very complacent, they'll kind of sit back and let just about anything happen to you. You know, we always found in service that it's such a small population of people that do the work. You know, I mean, it's like how many people in this room help put this convention on today. You know, there's a very small percentage of us that are really willing to give in that way. So those that do, certainly, you know, it's a small group of people, and we have a tendency to kind of feed on each other's good things and bad things, you know, to kind of get what we need, you know, negotiate. My experience would really come in the conventions, because that's what I was involved in. And just to give you a tad of this convention, Philadelphia Convention, because I think it really is special how it happened here, was that nobody in Philadelphia wanted to do it, you know, literally. Everybody was afraid, I guess, to take the risk. And I remember going around. At that time, we had just turned into a region. That was our very first year as a region. We'd always been what Al had described as this very large area of 65, 70 people, maybe not quite that many, but a bunch of people. We used to meet, remember Duane, at the YMCA in Norristown, which I believe is even torn down today. I don't know, is it still there? And we used to meet in the old YMCA in Norristown, is where area services was conducted. And that's where everybody, there's a lot of people who have since gone on to the Mid-Atlantic region, and groups as far away as Allentown, as far west, I guess, as Allentown, and as far south as Delaware and South Jersey, were all part of a area. You know, we were just an area. And out of that area, we were part of the Mid-Atlantic region, which comprised of about, I guess it was about 9 to 10 states. And some of those states had 2 or 3 meetings in them. You know, so there really wasn't a whole lot of traffic going on. But when the when we springboard into having the deciding that it was too chaotic, that actually it was a kind of a political decision, because we had all realized we had known that at that point that California was obviously taking up or making a lot of decisions about what service and what was happening with Narcotics Anonymous. And I think out of that fear, more than anything else, it motivated us to have our own representative in Philadelphia. And so as a result of that, we got the 5 areas together, Bucks, New Jersey, South Jersey, Philadelphia, Montgomery County, and Delaware, the state of Delaware, and Delaware County, together to form the region. That was strange. That was a pretty confidential meeting. There was about 6 of us that got together. A lot of arguments pursued because of the, the politicalness of it and the, you know, the control, and everybody wanted to make sure they had their spot in time. So, but the bottom line, the objective was, is that we really felt as though we needed a voice at the World Services, that we needed representation. That message had come through. It was time for us to bridge that gap, because literature, I have a letter that was written to the Board of Trustees, not the Board of Trustees, the World Service Office in California. At that time it was in Sun Valley. And the letter says we had asked them for Narcotics Anonymous information, where meetings are, how do you start a meeting, how do you form a committee. And they said to us in the letter, this is from World Service Offices in Sun Valley, you know, that there must be an Alcoholics Anonymous intergroup somewhere in your location. Find that intergroup and they'll tell you how to do it. You know. So that's what they did. The first Narcotics Anonymous structure was called Philadelphia Area Intergroup. So through that, as that transition went on, and we finally evolved into the 80s, because things really didn't, it was kind of a stagnating fellowship up until that point. You know, meetings would start and fold. I mean, just like us, you know, great starters but lousy finishers, you know. And we could never keep anything happening. We could never keep it going. There was really no consistency in many people's lives. As a result, though, finally, this connection with World Services, which I really believe that bridging that gap and giving us the maybe the political incentive to be more renowned and to be have more influence over, you know, quote, world decisions. We formed the Greater GPRCNN. So we're and the Greater Philadelphia region. So at that time, there was that was when the World Service Conference had just started to produce an agenda to be voted on at the conference. So we really needed a forum to have the agenda heard and a group conscience taken. In those days, group conscience was, you know, whatever you wanted it to be. And usually just that one person who happened to be there at the time was group conscience. And as a result, we needed this forum because suddenly, you know, we were coming in, the maturation process was occurring. You know, I think for us personally in recovery, and as a result of it happened for people in the fellowship at that time personally in recovery, it was happening to Narcotics Anonymous. So as part of this maturation process, the very first convention was not called the first convention. It was called our first conference because it was actually a service conference. It was not a convention. That too was a little dope fiendy because to keep up with other states like Florida who had just started their conventions, we wanted to make sure we had the same numerals on our flyers that they did, nothing less, you know. It's pretty sick, isn't it? But the point is that that very first conference, at that very first conference, we then, for the first time, the fellowship in NA from Philadelphia begun some attachment to other fellowships, other pockets of recovery throughout the country. And I guess through spearheading that collectively, those in Philadelphia who were responsible, it really is what, you know, brought the growth to this area. There's no doubt about it, that brought the growth to this region. So in that first conference, it was an overnighter at the Holiday Inn at 4th and Arch. Really all the day's events consisted primarily more than anything else of a banquet. You know what it was? It was like a high-dressed dance. We had tickets were $10, and that got you, it was Shrimp Newberg buffet, remember? And we had a dance with the DJ. And the taping of that that first meeting of the banquet speaker was, you know, the big boombox sitting in the back of the room. You know, that's how we taped that first meeting. During the day of the first, you know, so-called now today, referred to as a convention, we had a afternoon speaker, workshops throughout the day from about 10 o'clock on. We had no coffee at all. You had to buy coffee from the restaurant in the Holiday Inn for 50 cents. Everybody really loved that a lot, too. We had no coffee because we couldn't afford it. Because nobody in any other area believed enough, I guess, in ourselves that we could actually pull it off. So as a result, you know, there was no financial support. Plus, we didn't have money. You know, I can remember when the entire treasury from Narcotics Anonymous, it was the big news in NA. Somebody had absconded with the funds of NA. Do you remember, Dwayne? And some dude had to go to his bankroll, right, and replace the funds. You know, for all of NA, and at that time, you know, there really wasn't much of NA in the whole East Coast. You know, we were the starting point of NA in the East Coast. So outside of what NA, or what Al had referred to as that, that upshoot of meetings in New York City, which concluded real fast. But that was like such a big ordeal, you know. And all the dude had to replace was like $231, you know. But that was all the money we had to our name, so we had no capital funds to start a convention, so we couldn't supply coffee, you know. We couldn't fly anybody in, you know. We couldn't provide free registration packages, you know. There was only about remember negotiating the contract, and it was like pulling teeth to get 20 people to stay overnight, because if we didn't get 20 people to stay overnight, we were going to have to pay for the meeting room. And the meeting room, they wanted to charge us about $300 for. And that's how much we had started off with. You know, three of us had gotten together and threw $100 a piece in. And then we went down to the casinos and we made a little more out of it. And then so we really didn't have... We were more interested in making sure the newcomers... As a matter of fact, I don't see Jack. I saw him walk in for a second. A dude came over to me tonight, and there was two cats that got out of a treatment program that day, that very day. And this cat comes over to me, and he, you know, gives me a hug, and he says, "Do you remember me?" And I'm looking at him like, you know, who the fuck are you? I can't, you know, you look slick, you know, sharp as a tack, great. You know, I mean, I haven't seen him in almost 10 years. And he was one of the dudes that had called up on the telephone. We had a number on the registrations, and he said, "I'm leaving treatment today, and I don't have any place to go. I don't have any money. Is it all right if I come down and hang out with you?" Well, that was like, you know, overwhelming. So, of course, we invited him in. And you know what? The cat's been clean since then. You know that? That's wild, isn't it? So, both of them have. Both of them have. You know, our first it was our first one-dayer. Huh? How about it? You know, at our very first convention, right? The meeting... there was that, which was very important. We had that meeting for the agenda workshop where all the GSRs from the regions got together and, you know, they literally gave the RSR and the RSR alternate free conscience to do whatever they want. I mean, that's how we ran things, you know. We figured that we elected representatives and, you know, we gave them the opportunity to do with whatever voted they felt for, you know, they needed to do, you know, hopefully with our best interest in heart. We had made about Dutch made up about, I can't even remember, probably about 125 t-shirts, maybe not even that many, but they were really goofy looking things. It had, because there was a guy in the fellowship at the time that was terribly, terribly opposed to anything NA on a t-shirt, you know, in much, much opposition to it. And as a result of that, you know, to not create any extraordinary controversy in respect of him, all it had, it was a, and he got pink, you know, pink t-shirts, right, with a little pocket. They all had little pockets. And it had a little NA on the pocket, a real tiny, tiny little NA. I don't know if you have that in the archives or not, the first t-shirt. And I think it had the bell with the NA in it. And that became our symbol. That night, we made money, which was great, because I can remember, to be very frank about it, I can remember Dutch and I sitting outside in Fairmount section of Philadelphia and us debating who would sign their name on the contract, right? Because, you know, and we figured out that he had more to lose than I did, but he was going to lose it anyway, so put his name on it. And then Then he said, all right, I'll write my name. I mean, he'll tell you this himself, I'm sure, but he said, I'll write my name real small. We'll put both our names on it. And so once he figured he wrote his name on it, I talked him out of writing my name so I could just... But we did better. We did a little bit better than break even, which was really nice. And we were able to give our very first RSRs, regional service reps, money to go out with them to the World Service Conference to make a contribution to World Services, which was probably the first time, literally in that official capacity, we'd ever done so, certainly as a region. So that was a real nice thing. Then there was six people from New York. You have to remember, New York hadn't had 13 yet. And as a result of not having the World Convention in New York, there was only probably at that time, it was like maybe less, a half a dozen or less meetings in New York City. So they came, about 10 people came from New York, and one had shared, we had out-of-town speakers, one had shared during the day meeting, and for a long time that also was also a tradition. He used to share at every Philly meeting. Were you referring to Billy Z when you were saying about the dude in the wheelchair? Billy Z used to open every one of our conventions. Every single one. He would open it with an invocation. He used to open every banquet with an invocation. And the next morning we asked those same New York speakers to share in our very first spiritual meeting, which consisted of, I would say, about that many people right to there, if that. You know, there was probably about maybe 15 max out, 20 people at the spiritual meeting the following day. Because after all, nobody stayed overnight, you know. The conclusion, though, of that conference, so-called convention, meant that it had to become an annual affair. And I guess, you know, that leads us in right where we are today, certainly. And I'll tell you what, there's a big difference between today than there was then. There's no doubt about it. Some good and some bad. I mean, from my perspective, some good and some bad. Like Al said, you knew everybody. You know, if you knew 90%, you know, you didn't know everybody. You know, not you weren't that popular, you know. You knew everybody that was in NA then. And there was a real warmth to that. You know, there was a real kinship that we associated with one another. There was a real love for the newcomer. There was a real love for, a lot of respect and dignity and admiration for people that were struggling. Uncommon support. Because that reliance was so valuable to each and every one of us, that personal reliance, because I can remember years later being in personal tragedy, you know, locking myself up in the room, you know, taking the phone off the hook, you know, and after a number of days of that, surrendering to a basic text because of my pride and ego, not being able to share with another recovering people, pulling a basic text out and reading, recover and relapse. You know. But we didn't have that tool then. You know, it was mandatory that if you were in pain, if you were in trouble, that reliance was absolute. Or else you died. You know, there was no getting away from it. So, you know, that seemingly maybe to others very subtle difference, but nevertheless, you know, certainly there's a difference between today's NA and then. And then, of course, the significance in our numbers. You know, I think just reflecting back, the importance of a foundation, you know, and I say this for my own personal recovery, is as important as a foundation for any structure. And if it's not solid, if it's not real, if it's not the truth, then it crumbles apart. You know, it's like an old building, you know. It has to weather many storms. It has to weather the heat, the cold, the wind, the chill, the warmth. And if it's not a strong foundation, it tumbles. And I really always at especially NA history meetings, I think that, you know, whatever gratitude at any time we can give, you know, to those people who had that fortitude, that perseverance, that courage to stand alone at times, you know, so that we could be here today and have the convenience of recovery we do today, you know, we owe a tremendous amount of gratitude for, very seriously. Sometimes in NA, you know, we don't say that very well. You know, I'll never forget a Board of Trustee member walking out of the World Service Conference after he had given years and years and years of his life. And he just walked right out the back of the door. And nobody said anything to him. You know? I mean, I know there's a I know that, you know, our commitment to service is for, you know, for selfless reasons. Selfless reasons. You know, but I think that we owe respect and dignity and gratitude to those who literally put in that blood, sweat, and tears. Or else we wouldn't be here today. If those who host it, you know, a lot of times we, you know, we lose focus. It's we walk into a meeting, you know, 25 minutes after 8. You know, we lay our bump down, you know, and we hear what's being shared. You know, we get our thing off. We hug and leave. You know, forgetting that, you know, whoever found, you know, got that place, whoever's paying the rent, whoever's going every month to pick up the literature and bring back information that we need as a group, you know, pick up the chairs, clean the ashtrays, vacuum the floors. We used to have to wax the floors at the sobriety first group, you know. And then we used to pay them every 6 months, you know. But we lose sometimes focus on that part of it. It reminds me of a little story about complacency. I feel compelled to tell this story. I don't know why it's so silly. But there was this dude who got so upset with life. He became so discouraged in the day-to-day operations of life and its tragedies, and he decided that he was going to surrender to it. And he went up and he felt that prayer and meditation was his only answer, and give up on the world. So he went up, found a monastery way up in the hills. He went in to the head priestess and he explained his turmoil he'd been through, and he said to him, you know, I'm prepared to live here, endure for the rest of my life. And head priestess says, well, you must take a vow of silence. So he said, that's fine, anything to get out of tragedy. So he did, and he took a vow of silence. But every year, they would come around, and he would open up the door to his room, and behind the high priestess would follow an entourage, and he would look down at him, and he would say, okay, you've been here for a year, my son. You know, what is it? This is your one opportunity to break this vow of silence. What do you have to say? And he said, bed hard. The high priestess and his entourage walked out the door. Year had gone by, and he had fallen the strictest of silence. Comes by, and he walks into the room with his entourage. The high priestess looks at the gentleman, and he says, you've been here for 2 years, my son. You know, what would you like to say? And he goes, food cold. And they walk out of the room. Another year goes by, he walks in, high priestess, the entourage. He stares down at the young man, and he says, well, you've been here for 3 years now, my son. He said, what is it you have to say? And he goes, I quit. And the high priestess looks at him and he says, well, I figured so. All you've done is bitch and complain since you got here. So, I mean, if we remember, you know, sometimes it's easy to cry about things that aren't the way that we want them to be. You know, bitching and complaining, you know, talking about them doesn't make any sense. It doesn't do anything. You know, remember the people when you go into a meeting that prepared and got it set up for you, you know, because we owe them a lot of gratitude. This is where we get our life. And if it wasn't for those people involved in service, we wouldn't have one. Thanks.
I'd like to open this meeting up. Anyone want to share?
Wait. Let's do it, man. Come on, Wayne, kick it.
My name's Wayne. I'm a recovering addict.
It's kind of
hard, but I listened to Dutch, and I had heard of Dutch before he even got to the Pope, before he even found out what NA was. Somewhere along the line, I think it was in Chester County Prison, and I was like, I was trying to do something on a Saturday. I was trying to sneak up the car or something, and the guard caught me and asked him where I was gone, and I pointed to the kitchen. And so he opened the gate, and I saw some people in there. And I went in there, and they were having a NA meeting. And I didn't know what it was, so I just went in and I think said a couple of things, and enough time for the guy to get off my back, and then snuck back up. But I remember the guy was Dutch, and I think it was Brian T. or his brother, Ray. But anyway, it was weird, because like all them years, this was like in 74, 75. And just hearing him tonight, I realized that he was saying that he grew up in Westchester on East Bernard Street. And I was born in Westchester and raised up on East Minor Street, which is only one street away, you know. And I'm like, you know, but it's a coincidence, I guess. But I don't know, I was listening to his history, and then I was listening to the two up here. And I guess mine is what I remember of the program from when I came into it. It was basically the same, but I have a different understanding of it. And I guess that's what history is. They were saying if you got all the same history books on the Civil War, and if they all said the same thing, I guess I'd be all right, but they all don't. Everybody who wrote one has a different opinion on what happened. And so I guess it's from where they were at, or what they perceived that was happening. And I guess first I just want to say that I have 18 months this month. And I'm saying that because just to say that I left. You know, I went back out and had what they call a relapse. And, thank you. But I guess just to share what I saw with NA. And also, I like to say, I look at my relapse as, I guess, a reality of life. You know, it happened. And it happened, I think, I look at it today for a reason, to teach me something. And it's also a blessing that I guess my higher power chose that I wasn't to expire, that I was to come back. And but I guess what I look at was what kept me here when I was here. You know, because it's like I couldn't have been doing all the wrong things to stay around here, or not to use for, I guess, around 10 years. Yeah. You know? And I look at how I was introduced to the program, and it was through a rehab. And in the rehab, they had meetings, right? And it was like mostly a speaker would come up, but the residents in the rehab were the steering committee, as they called them. They were the secretary, the treasurer, and, you know, stuff like that. So the speaker would just come in, and they would introduce him, and they would speak. And in that rehab, for some reason, in the second week or so while I was in there, they chose me to be, I think, a chairman or something. And like I didn't know the first thing about it, but I was a good people pleaser and wanting to be longer. And it was like, it seemed like it fit my ego, you know. And I took it, and I guess from doing that, I learned something that I guess I didn't, I guess maybe I liked. You know, I liked the attention. So, now after I got out of rehab, I got a job there, and I did use, like, I think it was after about 11 months. I picked up for a one-nighter, and but that forced me to come to the rooms, before that, I think the period, 3 months after I got out to rehab and I was in what they called reentry, I didn't go to meetings because nobody in the house I was living in went to meetings, you know. But I guess I knew that the program was there. You know, my therapist at the time was in the program, you know. And I guess that's another thing that was common then, and it was understood, that you went to both fellowships. And I was even to the extent that we called it brothers and sister fellowships. And I hear people say that you know, they were, I guess with me, I didn't see, I understood NA to be NA and AA to be AA. And I wouldn't go into AA and give an NA message, and I wouldn't go into NA and give a AA message. It was kind of like an understood to me respect thing. You know, if they respected that you didn't speak about drugs, you didn't speak about it. And if they, NA respected, suggested that you didn't talk about AA, you didn't talk about it. Yeah, and that's just basically what I understood of. But, anyway, I came to meetings basically because, after I picked up, and also, I was in the gambling. I remember I was in the house gambling. And I wanted to get away from Sunday nights, you know, at the house. Because I was in a lot of debt and people were starting to, not give me any, loan me any money. So I started going to the Y meeting in Norristown. And, from that, I met people. I met my first sponsor and I picked him because he told a story about gambling. And, that's why I picked him in NA. And, from that, I didn't know as people took me to meetings. You know, they told me to go to meetings, and I guess that's another thing that I hear people say, there was no meetings. And I don't know that I went to an NA meeting if I wanted to 7 days a week. You know, and I guess from here, it was I went to the Y on Sunday, I went to 4th and Broad and Lansdale on Tuesday, on Monday, I went to the Plymouth Meat Mall on Tuesdays. I went to 4th and Pine on, no, 4th and Pine hadn't started. That started a couple years later. Wednesday, I think we had commitments at Chester County Farm. And I went there for a couple years. And on Thursday, we went to Evansburg Road. And, yeah, Evansburg Road and Germantown Pike. And Friday, and after I was around for about 9 months, they started to build one up at Norristown State. Right? And Saturday, we went dancing. And that was basically, that was the week, you know. But it was all, you know, I think a lot of the other stuff, there was a lot of fellowship. I was fortunate to get a car, you know. And I guess that was one, I had little superstitions. You know, I guess that fed into my gambling. But I felt that if I always put money, a dollar in the basket, I'd always have money. And if I always was willing to take people in my car, I'd always have a car. And every night, I took people in my car. And my sponsor, who was my therapist at one, when I was in the rehab, he was kind of my other fellowship sponsor. He made sure I had people. Every time somebody was getting out of Eagleville, he would send them to me. And I'd take them to meetings. And so it was like I was, and I'd get into service, and I learned service, I guess, through necessity. I didn't have nothing else to do, so I did that. And it was the same way with our area service. It was suggested that I was at the, I think the first commitment I got for area services was through, Plymouth Meeting Mall meeting. And when I got there, they had a, back in, it was if you had, in order to be a, be on a board or be anything in area service, you had to be a representative from a group. So my first thing was literature. And the first thing I did was I had to write to California, call to California. I had to call California, tell them how much literature I wanted, and put a check in the mail or money order, and they'd send me that if they had it. And then I think the second one was after that. I did that for a year. It was secretary. And I remember the $99 was our total a lot of times, $98, and the bills came to like, you know, $30 or $40 for the whole area. And but you know, those things kept me going, and I did all the little crazy things like take, you know, spend the money during the week or during the month and put it back by area service time, and I got away with that. And then I remember the literature crisis, where it was with California had a dry spell in literature, and I remember at one point we were going to write our own literature, and we did. We started Xeroxing the pieces of literature, and then California somehow got wind of it, and they told us that was illegal, and then we started the feuds. And but I don't know. So to me, like I said, the program was, it was all about just staying clean. You know, there was different theories going around at the time, and I guess one of them was from the rehab, because rehabs had went the program, they had their own idea. That I know there's one point that if you were a heroin addict,